Today is Monday, the 21st of May, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, we take a look at the agreement the United States made with China to avert a trade war.
This does not address the problems for American companies in China.
Plus, President Donald Trump demands the Justice Department investigate whether the FBI infiltrated his campaign. What we expect from tomorrow's U.S.-South Korea summit, and weeks before women will officially be allowed to drive for the first time in Saudi Arabia, some are gearing up for that big day. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says he's going to demand the Justice Department investigate whether the FBI infiltrated his 2016 campaign. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani gets us going.
It's an extraordinary order from the president, who has been promoting a theory circulating in conservative circles about a possible FBI spy on the campaign. His pressure on the Justice Department hit a new intensity with his tweet yesterday ordering an investigation, reading, "I hereby demand and will do so officially tomorrow." The department's already moving to defuse a potential confrontation, asking its internal watchdog to expand an existing probe of the FBI's actions, though it's unclear if that will satisfy the president. The tweet came hours before his legal team said the special counsel's indicating its investigation into the president could end by September. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And now joining me in the studio to put things in a little bit more context, VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone.
Hi, Steve.
So the president tweeted over the weekend, again this morning, writing that the probe was a, quote, political hit job. Has the president moved on any of his tweets so far?
Well, the thing we're looking at here is this intelligence source that has apparently been dealing with the FBI, was in contact with some Trump campaign associates in 2016. People who had some ties with Russia in some way, the president is taking that and turning that into the FBI planted informants in his campaign. There's no proof of that at this time. So what we do see here is a pattern, though, of the president grabbing at anything he can, I think, to undermine the Mueller probe on Russia writ large. And this has been an escalating campaign in recent weeks, particularly, I think, with the addition of Rudy Giuliani on his defense team.
And we should note that some of the senators who are on the Intelligence Committee have come out and said this is concerning to make these kind of statements out in the public open. There's some concern about whether or not this could damage the Justice Department's ability to use informants in the future. But why is the president taking this strategy at this point to go after the probe at this juncture?
Well, it seems as though they're fighting a two-front war. They're fighting legally on some issues as to when, for example, and how will they sit down with Robert Mueller to do an interview about the investigation. But they actually are fighting more aggressively on the political front. It's actually aimed at public relations, at shoring up the president's base, and sowing seeds of non-credibility in the Mueller probe so that no matter what it comes out with, his supporters won't necessarily believe it. The other issue here, though, that we heard in the report is very important, that traditionally in our country, there is a separation between the presidency and actually ordering the Justice Department to do certain things, to take certain lines of investigation. There's sort of an unwritten rule going back throughout American history that generally has barred that, but President Trump seems to be pushing the envelope on that quite a bit.
Now, we also heard that Rudy Giuliani said that he got word from the special counsel that the probe is going to be wrapped up by September 1. Is that in line with historic investigations?
Everything we've heard about what the special counsel is going to do has come from everybody but the special counsel. And particularly Giuliani in recent weeks has tried to put forward some of his conversations. I think there's a political aspect to this. They want to create momentum to get this thing wrapped up as soon as possible. The question as to when this will end, there's one person who knows or has an idea, and he is not talking. That's Robert Mueller.
Robert Mueller. Jim Malone is VOA senior political correspondent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Here are some other top stories from around the globe. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has unveiled a far-reaching list of demands for any new nuclear deal with Iran and threatened economic crushing sanctions if Tehran does not change its behavior. The Central Intelligence Agency's first female director, Gina Haspel, was sworn in today. Haspel endured a tumultuous nomination process in which lawmakers revisited the CIA's past interrogation practices. The Democratic Republic of Congo plans to launch an Ebola vaccination program on Monday to stop another widespread outbreak of the deadly disease. More than 4,000 doses of the vaccine have been shipped to Mbandaka. For additional stories and in-depth coverage, visit our website, voanews.com, or download our mobile app to take the stories with you. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Some people who want to lose weight quickly may engage in periods of short-term fasting. While taking breaks from food might help with initial weight loss, doctors say it could also cause various health problems and, ironically, cause your body to burn calories more slowly than if you were eating a normal diet. A new study suggests fasting every other day also increases the risk of developing diabetes. Brazilian researchers who worked with lab rats found that fasting can weaken the action of insulin, a hormone that helps regulate our body's sugar levels. Previously conducted research also indicates that such fasting can produce free radical molecules, which are said to cause damage to the body at a cellular level and may be connected with cancer risk, impaired organ function, and faster aging. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. China has welcomed an agreement reached with the United States last week averting a tariff war over the trade imbalance, market access, and forced technology transfers. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin appeared on Fox News Sunday. He spoke of meaningful progress.
We agreed on a framework, which is important to understand. And the framework includes their agreement to substantially reduce the trade deficit by increasing their purchases of goods. We also discussed very important structural issues that they're going to make in their economy to make sure that we have a fair ability to compete there. And also protections about technology, which have been very important to the president. We're putting the trade war on hold. So right now we have agreed to put the tariffs on hold while we try to execute the framework. The president has been very clear since the first meeting with President Xi in Mar-a-Lago that we are going to reduce the trade deficit. We have an agreement with China. We are immediately going to follow this up with Secretary Ross going there with very hard commitments in agriculture, where we expect to see a very big increase, 35% to 40% increases in agriculture this year alone, in energy, doubling the energy purchases. I think that you could see $50, $60 billion a year of energy purchases over the next 3 to 5 years.
There's been no mention in the communique of the sanctioned Chinese telecom giant ZTE Corporation, which uses U.S. components and had to cease most operations after a 7-year ban was imposed for violating U.S. sanctions. Grant Newsham is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that he doesn't think very much of the agreement following 2 days of talks in Washington. In his view, it does not address deep-seated problems in the bilateral trade relationship.
This does not address the problems for American companies in China, the forced technology theft, intellectual property violations right and left, and the simple inability to enforce a contract. So this is really, as I say, it represents the thinking, part of the administration, that if you just get in the room with people, you can solve all your problems, almost as if you're dealing with Canadians instead of Chinese.
Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross is going to go to Beijing to flesh out the details. What is the success of that? We know the Chinese are very tough negotiators.
Oh, I think the Chinese are going to do very well. Already they have, apparently, stringing the Americans along, making some initial concessions, which may benefit a few American companies, a few industries. But once again, do not go to the fundamental problems with the Chinese economy, where it's a rigged casino. And that is something that requires just a fundamental transformation of Chinese economy, society, indeed psychology. And that is not to be done in an afternoon or in a weekend by some U.S. negotiators. The Americans had a good hand to play, and they played it pretty well after the ZTE sanctions, and apparently decided they don't like winning, so have going to go negotiate. But I think the Chinese must be laughing behind their backs.
Speaking of ZTE, Larry Kudlow suggested that if any of the remedies are altered, they'll still be going very, very tough, including big fines, compliance measures, new management, new boards. Don't expect ZTE to get off scot-free. It ain't going to happen.
Oh, I think the Chinese still must be laughing. So he can say that. But once again, after only about a week, they have actually backed off. And this promise that, they're not going to ease up on ZTE, they're going to hold that over the Chinese heads. Now, that almost reminds you of a parent saying, well, this time I mean it, you'd better stop misbehaving. This time I mean it. I just don't think the Chinese take it seriously. After all that ZTE has done, after the very strong sanctions the Americans put on it a week later, really for nothing more than a promise to talk more and maybe buy some American soybeans and sorghum and maybe some liquid natural gas or oil, well, that's all booked to get the Americans to talk again. If that's your objective, is to just keep talking, well, that's an American approach. It's best to operate from a position of real strength and really be just unwilling to concede on what you, on your position. And unfortunately, that half of the American administration that thinks that you can talk this out in a weekend with the Chinese, they seem to have the upper hand, and that's not a good thing. You know, of course, for all commentators like me, you know, we're sort of watching from the gallery, and there may be more going on that we don't know about. Where this is a very clever chess game that's being played by the administration, but I doubt it.
Grant Newsham said an effective U.S. trade policy toward China would demand reciprocity. Whatever Chinese companies are allowed to do in the U.S. market, American firms must be allowed to do in China. Venezuela's election board says incumbent President Nicolas Maduro has been reelected for a second six-year term. Sunday's election was boycotted by the opposition as the coronation of a dictator and condemned by much of the international community. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert went as far as to say that the elections were not legitimate. Joining me earlier on the phone was Moises Rendon. He is the associate director and associate fellow of the CSIS Americas program, where he provides analysis on a range of public policy issues in Latin America. Now that Maduro has secured his second term, what is that going to show, manifest impact for the everyday citizen in Venezuela?
Venezuela is going to an unprecedented man-made crisis, not from all the spectrum, from economic, humanitarian, political, institutional point of view. And the results of this election is only going to make this situation worse for the Venezuelan people. Because we haven't seen any sign from the Maduro regime to make any reforms, any changes on their policies. So the results of this election is just the reconfirmation of the status quo in Venezuela.
If we step back from Venezuela itself and take a look at regional implications, regional politics, what kind of effect will Maduro have?
The Maduro regime is isolated right now from the international community. And the international community already said that they won't recognize the results of these elections. And in fact, the Lima Group, which is a group of Latin American countries, already this morning said that they're not recognizing the results. And this is going to bring a very important turning point for the Venezuelan crisis. Because as for yesterday, Maduro was recognized as the president of Venezuela. But today we have a different picture where countries, democratic countries around the world are saying we're not recognizing the results, so therefore we're not recognizing Maduro as the president of Venezuela. But there is an important point here to make clear. Nicolas Maduro is going to be the president of Venezuela no matter what happened yesterday until January 2019. So we have this very long gap between now and January 2019 where Maduro is going to start making political, economic moves, trying to present himself as a legitimate president of Venezuela.
Moises Rendon is the associate director and associate fellow of the CSIS Americas program. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
And this is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is meeting President Donald Trump Tuesday at the White House. The pair spoke by phone on Sunday for about 20 minutes about the planned U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore that's scheduled to take place on June 12th with Kim Jong-un. I spoke with Harry Kazianos via Skype earlier today. He's the director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest.
What do you see as the major points of discussions between President Moon Jae-in of South Korea and President Donald Trump when they have their one-day summit on Tuesday?
I think it's very simple. I think President Moon might actually have a Mission Impossible ahead of him. I think that there is not actually going to be a summit. I think what's going on between the Trump administration and North Korea is that they're just too far apart in terms of what denuclearization actually means between both sides, what the terms of denuclearization would actually be, the timetables of what that would look like, if there would be inspectors. And I think that's all very hard to do, considering that the United States and North Korea really have no mutual trust between them.
So you bring up this notion of the United States and North Korea being very far apart. If we take a look back to the North-South summit on April 27th, they released that Panmunjom declaration. And if you look at the language of that, it's very similar to the two previous declarations. If you look at North Korea's actions, are they taking any steps that would even indicate that they are looking towards some kind of denuclearization?
Absolutely not. The North Koreans have not done anything that could be reversed. I mean, for example, they made a big deal about saying, oh, we're not going to test long-range missiles anymore. Well, they could test long-range missiles within 2 to 4 days' notice. They just have to have good weather, have the optics ready so Kim Jong-un can take those nice photo ops for social media of his ICBMs. So that's pretty fast. The North Koreans could test nuclear weapons again. I know there's a lot of talk and satellite images being passed around social media showing them dismantling their nuclear testing grounds. Well, guess what? They could reconstitute those within a few weeks to maybe 2 to 3 months.
I want to get your take on one last thing. The New York Times reported that President Trump is becoming concerned that the summit could turn into a political embarrassment. What exactly is the political risk to the president in having a summit with Kim Jong-un?
Simple. He doesn't want to look like he's doing Iran deal 2.0. I mean, the big thing that he is worried about is he doesn't want to have any sort of agreement where, you know, it's the North Koreans are getting a whole bunch of goodies up front and then, you know, they would slowly sort of denuclearize. I think the actual play here that could be possible is a very rigorous step-by-step approach where North Korea actually agrees to give up their nuclear weapons within, say, 2.5 years, maybe by the ending of the President Trump's first term. And you'd go in a step-by-step format that could be reversed if the North Koreans decide to cheat.
Harry Kazianos is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Weeks before they will officially be allowed to drive for the very first time, women in Saudi Arabia are gearing up for that very big day. While some are taking driving lessons, others have already picked out their cars and can't wait to take them for a spin. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
A month ahead of the date they can legally hit the road, Saudi women tried their hands behind the wheel at an auto expo specifically targeted at the new drivers-to-be.
I am so happy and I want to have a look at the cars, their models, what suits me exactly, the prices, the options.
To experience what it's like to drive, many women got into simulators.
I was very pleased with the decision to allow women to drive. I already bought my car, and as soon as they give us the green light, I will start driving immediately.
Improving women's mobility by giving them access to their own transportation is a welcome move, says one Saudi woman.
It's a nice step for the Saudi people, and especially for the Saudi woman, to be self-dependent, so she can finish her own work without relying on someone else, like a driver, or her brother, or her father.
On the sidelines of the expo, driving instructors were on hand to offer basic classes in the rules of the road.
I'm so happy. And by the way, I applied for the driver's license. I felt like I had made an achievement.
Seemingly calm in the back seat, this young woman can't wait for the thrill of sitting in the driver's seat.
I swear by God, it's an amazing feeling. But the most important thing is that you have the courage not to be afraid of anything. I am very happy.
In a decree issued last September, King Salman ordered an end to the ban on women drivers by June. According to reports, the move could add about 9 million additional drivers and lift Saudi car sales by up to 20% annually. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And you know what? One final note before we head out today. On this day, back in 1927, Charles A. Lindbergh landed his Spirit of St. Louis monoplane near Paris, France, completing the very first solo airplane flight across the Atlantic Ocean. The time to take that journey, a whopping 33 and a half hours. Think now today we can do it in just a fraction of that time. Pretty amazing. Well, that's going to do it for us today. I'd like to thank Steve Koresh for directing today's show, as well as John Dryden for engineering the broadcast. But most importantly, I want to thank you for spending part of your day with us and listening to the show. And if you haven't, be sure to check out the Voice of America on social media. You know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, where you'll find pictures, stories, videos, and more. Well, you know what? I am Steve Miller in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Oil-rich Venezuela has for decades been one of Latin America's most affluent countries. In those days, when Venezuela experienced manpower shortages, thousands of people would cross the border from neighboring Colombia to find work. These days, the shoe is on the other foot. Thanks in large part to mismanagement by the government of President Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela is in an economic and political crisis. There is no food, no medicine, no jobs, and no end in sight. So Venezuelans are fleeing the country in droves. Most are going to Colombia. Every day, about 35,000 people cross the Simon Bolivar International Bridge and head for the closest large city, Cúcuta, just a few kilometers to the north. About half of them purchase food and medicine there, visit family or conduct business, and return home. Some keep moving, heading to Chile, Argentina, or Peru. But every day, about 5,000 stay in Cúcuta. And when they arrive, nearly all are in need of food and medical attention. This exodus of Venezuelans desperate to leave the poverty and repression in their native country has been going on for 2 years now. The people and government of Cúcuta are doing what they can, but they are overwhelmed and underfunded. So Colombia's president has appealed to the international community for help, and the United States is responding. On May 8th, the U.S. government announced an additional $18.5 million in bilateral funding to support the displaced Venezuelans in Colombia. Subject to a congressional approval, this funding will go towards school feeding programs for children in communities most impacted by the influx, mobile health services to provide vital health care for underserved populations, and registry and border data collection systems to help the government of Colombia make informed and timely decisions regarding Venezuelans seeking assistance. This new funding complements the more than $21 million in humanitarian assistance the United States has provided since 2017 for Venezuelans who have fled their country and for the neighboring countries hosting them. We urge the friends and neighbors of Venezuela and Colombia, as well as the global community, to follow our example.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.